You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert. We don't know when Frederick Douglass was born. That date was never recorded, nor told to him, because he was born a slave. But we do know the date of his death, February 20th, a day that ended one of the most remarkable lives in the history of America. Douglass educated himself, freed himself, chose his own name, turned his story into a best-selling book that became a narrative engine for the abolitionist cause, joined the movement for women's suffrage, founded his own newspaper, and from that platform, helped move President Lincoln to free the slaves of the South, something that Lincoln was very much against at the outset of the Civil War. Much of Douglass's speaking and writing was part of a grand project of rehumanizing slaves by telling his own story. And our next guest has taken that work to a new medium. In his lifetime, Douglass embraced public speaking, publishing, portrait photography. Now he's in a nonfiction graphic novel. The writer behind that work is David Walker. He's good enough to join us from the studios of our affiliate station, KABU in Portland. Thank you so much for coming on.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be on.
So you are super accomplished in the world of comics. You have been in charge of the storylines of some of the most prominent black superheroes in the world, Luke Cage, Shaft, Cyborg at DC Comics. Why did you decide to make the move into nonfiction writing?
Nonfiction was something that I had always had my eyeball on. There was several projects that I had been thinking about, a couple that I'd been developing. Frederick Douglass wasn't one of those, but when the opportunity came up, it was like the golden opportunity. It was a chance for me to explore nonfiction, which again was something I really wanted to do, but it was also the opportunity to do a deep dive into the life of somebody that I thought I knew something about, but then I realized it was just the tip of the iceberg.
What did that research process look like? What did you learn that you didn't know?
Oh, everything, just about. I mean, I had an old beat up copy of The Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass sitting on my bookshelf that had probably been sitting there for about 20 years. That's the first of his three autobiographies. I didn't even have the other two, nor did I know that there were two other autobiographies. It was sort of a, I call it like the elementary school history of Frederick Douglass's life that was, at least that was I was retaining in my brain. And, you know, I didn't really know anything about much of his life other than the fact that he escaped from slavery. I didn't know anything about, you know, you mentioned earlier his interest in portrait photography. He was the most photographed American of the 19th century. Very acutely aware of at that time what mass media was, and in some ways was probably arguably the first celebrity to emerge from here within the United States. It's certainly the most celebrated person who was not an elected official in the U.S. or royalty in Europe. And that's just sort of the beginning of what I learned.
Yeah, reading your graphic novel made me realize a lot of my knowledge stops at the end of The Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass, too, because that's the autobiography he put out that was a bestseller. It's the one that still lands on college syllabi for people studying the run-up to the Civil War. But it ends with him exiting slavery, and it's just like the opening period in his life of decades of dedicated activism and organizing.
Yeah, oh, it's very much like it's almost like the first act in a grand three-act play, and in his second work, and then the third work, you know, he details how he met Abraham Lincoln. He details later on how he actually escaped from slavery. There's so much stuff that first book doesn't cover, and you realize, you know, even for myself, it was like, oh, wait a sec, there's so much more here. And then there was also one of the big things that I really discovered was how history was recorded both by outside historians, by the mass media, and then by individuals. So, for example, you know, Frederick Douglass was married to the same woman for 40-something years, but he almost never talked about her, and there's very little written about her. And then what I began to discover was that was considered bad form back then to talk about your marriage and your wife and those sort of relationships. And she played such an integral role in his life. And that was one of the frustrating things for me during research, was how little I was able to find out about Anna Marie Douglas. And it's still sort of an itch that I'll need to scratch at some point in my life.
Yeah, I mean, particularly because for his time, he was an incredible champion of women's rights. He attends the Seneca Falls Convention, where the suffrage movement is born. And he lands harder on the question of suffrage than some of the women there do.
He also had a bit of a contentious relationship with some of the members of the suffrage movement. And again, as I was doing research on his life, there were so many other people and so many other subjects that began to open up to me that I realized if you're lucky, if you're curious about history and you study it with any degree of interest, most of us, most of the people who do that, such as myself, have, I guess, for lack of a better term, almost like a Cliff Notes understanding of history. We don't know that much. And then you start to begin to do these deep dives and all these things open up. And then the next thing you know, in my case, you know, I had a stack of books on Frederick Douglass that's, you know, probably a good 2-3 feet high, maybe 4 feet high. And then, but next to it, there's, you know, books on Susan B. Anthony and books on Harriet Tubman and John Brown and Abraham Lincoln and all these people who, you know, were connected to him in one capacity or another.
A couple themes come up the way you tell this story. One is that from a very early age, about 16 years old, Frederick Douglass is someone who will risk taking a severe beating rather than submit to people who have the power to end his life.
Yeah, he, you know, there's, it's interesting because I would love to have met him and talked to him and interviewed him and gotten to know him to really get a better sense of what was going on in his head. But I think that he, at a very early age, when he was first learning how to read and his master forbade him from learning, there was this connection that went on in his mind, and he realized the importance of knowledge and the importance of what someone could take away from him and how much control he had over his own life and his own destiny. And it became sort of the driving narrative for him, was that he wanted to be in control no matter what. And you know, he talks about how they could break his body but not break his spirit. And a lot of people will say those things, but they don't understand what that means literally, to have your body broken, to take the sort of physical abuse that he went through and that he witnessed within members of his own family on the plantation where he grew up, and then what he saw later on in life.
It was probably in the third fist fight that it kind of clicked for me why his story works so well in comic panels, in a medium that we usually associate with superheroes.
Yeah, it was, you know, it was one of those things where there's a lot of moments in his life that lend themselves to strong visual storytelling, whether in our case it was the graphic novel, but I think it could also work in you know, film or television or something like that. His first failed attempt at his escape, but then his second successful escape attempt. The second one, when you're reading about it in the third book that he wrote, it's almost like an episode of Mission Impossible, and it's so incredibly fascinating. And he had a tendency to downplay some of this stuff. He would often say that, oh, his escape wasn't nearly as exciting or interesting because all he did was hop on a train, then take a boat, and he was free within under 24 hours. But it was so much more than that.
Yeah. I mean, he's interesting as a narrator because one of the things he wrestles with from very early on, when he's doing basically the abolitionist speaking circuit in the North, is that he is such an articulate narrator, people in the audience don't believe he was ever a slave.
Yeah, no, and that's a... He talked about that a lot. And I think that sort of, you know, that played into both the racism and the preconceived notions and the ideologies of that era. But all that stuff still comes into play now. You know, we still have you know, people will say, oh, you know, you're so articulate, or you don't sound like other black people, or, you know, things like that. Like, there's this, again, there's these prejudices and these preconceived notions of what people of color are supposed to sound like, what we're supposed to talk about, how much we're supposed to know, how articulate we're supposed to be. And it's interesting, you know, here he was dealing with this 200 years ago, and in some cases, we're still dealing with this now.
So you made the editorial decision, after a lot of wrestling, to have this book narrated in the voice of Frederick Douglass, but to do that without quoting from his writing, because people in the 19th century did not write sentences of a suitable length for comic panels.
No, not at all. Not by any stretch of the imagination. And even you take one of his speeches and, you know, they would be, for him to get up and stand in front of an audience to give one of his speeches might take an hour or two. I mean, these were long. You have to remember that this was an era before film and TV and radio and the internet and all these things. So public speaking was actually considered a form of entertainment. It was a big deal. And public speakers would do these very long presentations. And I remember at one point when I was in the early phases of working on the book, I was like, yeah, you know, maybe we can have him, you know, have a page or two dedicated to one of his speeches and like actually reprint the speech as it was. And then it became very clear that that wasn't going to happen, because it was, not only was it too long, but there was, you know, there was terminology that would be difficult for people to fully comprehend, that wouldn't translate well. And so what I did was I just spent a lot of time reading his work, getting the gist of what he was saying, writing it in a very contemporary way, and then reworking it so that it had a bit more formality to it. And I essentially, I was doing my best to imitate his voice in terms of how it read, not necessarily how it would sound, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think you nailed it. I mean, I hadn't read Autobiography of Frederick Douglass since I was in college a long time ago. And the way you wrote the graphic novel made me feel like I was hearing his voice again.
Well, thank you. Yeah, no, it was, and again, I, as you said earlier, I wrestled with that. It was a very difficult decision, because I didn't want it to come across as being either flippant or just cheap, I guess. I think that there was a possibility that it would have sounded like a either cheap or cheat with a T, and I didn't want either of those. But I also knew that what I had written earlier was just boring. You know, it was very dry and lifeless, which is that's sort of the flip side. That's one of the dangers of the graphic novel medium, is that certain types of narratives can read very, very dry. And I didn't want that. I knew that people would just get would walk away from it. They would get bored and they wouldn't care. But I also realized that was, in a lot of ways, was counter to everything that Frederick Douglass was doing with his entire life, which was he was asserting his voice. He was asserting his humanity. And I knew that I had to do that. And so once I fully embraced that decision, then it became easier. Then it was just a question of convincing my editor that this was the direction to go.
One of the things that makes him so interesting as a figure is that at different points in his life, he lands in like very different modes of political consciousness. The early part of his life is kind of devoted to improving himself and then liberating himself. He comes to abolitionism through, you know, his relationship with William Lloyd Garrison, who is committed to nonviolent abolition of slavery. But he comes to conspire with John Brown in trying to foment a slave uprising to overthrow the institution of slavery in the South, a violent revolution. And towards the very end of his life, with the Civil War in the rearview mirror, and I had never known this till I read your book, he's someone who actually goes through a kind of a reconciliation process with the people who used to own him.
Yeah, no, and for him, I think it's very interesting, because there's a certain amount of controversy around like his relationship with his former owner. There's some people who you know, want to believe that they never reconciled, even though he said that they did. And then there's people that sort of feel like that should be glossed over. I think one of the things that's very interesting is that he didn't have a particularly good relationship with his owners, but he didn't have a terrible relationship with them either. And he talks about that a lot. He talks about that he was as far as slavery goes, his life at times was very unique and very different than a lot of other slaves, especially slaves in the Deep South. He was primarily in the Baltimore area and in parts of Maryland, which is very different than, say, the experience in some place like Mississippi or Arkansas. And I think for him, it was as part of his narrative. And again, he was a celebrity. You know, everybody knew who he was. I think it was very important for him to take control of his narrative, knowing that people would look to that as being sort of a truth, if not the truth of what needed to happen, but a truth of what could happen. And I think that was important for him to find peace with his owner and to show that peace could be made. And that if he didn't make that sort of peace, that we would have this sort of problems that we're having right now. You know, it's the, so many of the issues that we have dealing with race in this country come from the fact that none of us are willing to make peace with who we are, where we are, and not only what's been done to us, but making peace with how we respond to it. There's a type of forgiveness that it says to another person, I'm no longer going to lease space to you within my being. I'm no longer going to concern myself with the things that you've done to me. I'm going to move on with my life. And I think that was part of what he was trying to do. And I think he was just, again, he was trying to, as the nation was healing after the Civil War and not making things work during Reconstruction, I think he was sort of looking at what can each of us do as individuals and taking a sort of moral high ground and again, reconciling with these people that had treated him like property. I think maybe he was trying to do that as an example for other people, but the problem was that you need both parties to come to that reconciliation. You need one person to say, I'm going to forgive you what you did to me, but that the person who's saying I forgive you, they are going to need to hear some type of apology. And a lot of that never came. There was a lot of, you know, post-slavery, post-Civil War, there was a lot of blaming the slaves for the war, blaming the slaves for everything that the Confederacy went through. And that's sort of the bigger form of denial that was going on and honestly is still going on today.
And it's not like he becomes a pushover late in life. He definitely supports then-President Ulysses S. Grant suspending habeas corpus to jail and crack down on the resurgent Ku Klux Klan.
Yeah, he's, you know, I think, and I didn't get into a lot of the stuff later in his life. Part of it was just because we were limited by our page count. But it also got to a point where if we're going to talk about a life in acts, or, you know, and apply a three-act structure to it, like Frederick Douglass's life did not have three acts, just like none of our lives have three acts. They have four and five and six acts. And once you start getting into like the Grant presidency and his some of Douglass's appointments to office and the travels that he did, even his second marriage after Anna died, that's a second, maybe even a third graphic novel. And so I just got to a point where deadlines were coming in and I realized I'm either going to have to cut a lot of stuff that's already here, or I'm going to have to wind it down and hope that either there's this, you know, maybe someone else will do a graphic novel that focuses on this other stuff, because there's so much other stuff that could be talked about.
We're speaking to David Walker. He's an award-winning comic writer who's been in charge of some of the world's most famous black heroes, including Shaft and Luke Cage. His newest book is his first adventure into nonfiction in that medium. It is called The Life of Frederick Douglass. So let's talk a little bit about some of the editorial decisions you made putting this timeline together. There are several points in the book where you do break into kind of straight chronological history, throwing up a timeline of slavery or a multi-page explainer on the Civil War. You feel like you have more information than you could cram into the comic panels?
Oh, there's way too much. I mean, you could do an entire graphic novel on slavery in America. You could do an entire series of graphic novels on the Civil War. My feeling was that I didn't want to fail to contextualize those two important pieces. Those are two big elephants in the room when we're talking about not only the history of America but the life of Frederick Douglass. And it just seemed to me that that it's 2019 and there are still people who believe that the Civil War was fought over states' rights. Okay. And I couldn't write a book about a graphic novel about Frederick Douglass and slavery and abolitionism and not address the Civil War and at least give some sort of commentary on what the real causes were. And we talked about this. I talked about this with my editor, and I just felt like a lot of times, especially with graphic novels, there's this, we try to cram in all the information, like a birth to death examination of a person's life, without giving the certain important contexts. And I also knew that there would be, in all likelihood, some young people or college students reading this book. And if this is going to be someone's first dive into the life of Frederick Douglass, I wanted to make sure that there was at least a few bits of key information about the larger picture of what was going on in this country and during his time.
Who did you have in the mind as a reader when you wrote the book?
I had in mind, I guess, myself at about the age of 13 or 14. I thought about, I actually teach part-time. I teach at Portland State University. I teach a writing class. But I thought about what I was like as a student and every time I would have to do research on something and I would get a big giant book that was like 700 pages long and I would feel so intimidated because I wasn't the best student when I was younger. So I thought about trying to put this together for people who were interested in knowing more, but didn't necessarily know where to start. And because, you know, when I was started doing research on Frederick Douglass, one of the first things I discovered was a lot of the books are pretty dense and impenetrable, you know? And so if a 14-year-old kid has to do a report on Frederick Douglass, you know, I hope that my book isn't the only book that they use, but I wanted it to be a good entry point. And so I thought about that. I thought I really did. I wrote it for myself, the not the best student in the world. I was a curious kid, but I was only curious about the things I wanted to know about as opposed to things that, you know, were the homework assignments.
Yeah, I guess that's one of the things I really appreciated about it is that his work was never intended to be dense or impenetrable. I mean, his autobiography, his newspaper, The North Star, the 160 portrait photographs he took, these were all him using the popular media of the time to try to reach a popular audience. It's just with the passage of time, the language gets a little less accessible.
Exactly. I mean, honestly, again, if you look at a book that's, say, 700 pages and no pictures, it's a lot more intimidating than a graphic novel. You know, you put that 700-page book in front of, I don't care who it is, the vast majority of people, if you put that a graphic novel in front of somebody in a 700-800-page, big, thick, hardcover book, most people they might pick up that book, flip through it for a little bit, but they're going to pick up that graphic novel and go, well, you know, what's this? They can read it in an hour or two. And I think that, you know, anything that gets people reading and gets them learning and sparks their imagination, sparks their curiosity and their intellect, I'm fine with it.
Yeah, I love it as a medium. And it's not a medium I work in, just one I consume. Because when it's done well, it is so information dense in terms of how much it conveys relative to your commitment of time. Because someone like you has gone over every word with a scalpel, asking if it's necessary or not, and asking how much of the work can be done through the drawings.
That's it. And this is sort of what I tell my students, is that you've got to find that balance between text and image, and every word is precious, and you're limited by space. in graphic novels, and there's a limited amount of space on the page, a limited number of pages in the book, and you've got to find a way to make it work. I love that challenge.
It seems like in the fictional world of comics, this is a great time to be trying to get more attention to Black characters, particularly with Marvel's runaway successes on the big screen. Do you think there would have been a market or interest from publishers in a book like this 5-6 years ago?
There's a good chance there wouldn't have been a market there would have been a market, but most publishers wouldn't have recognized it. And now I think we're just seeing it open up. I definitely think that there's more room to maneuver, and there's in graphic novels and Black characters. I think both fiction and nonfiction. On the nonfiction side, that's what's really intriguing to me. I have to be 100% honest. I am sort of looking at my life and looking at my career and looking at how much time I potentially have left and seeing that there's not enough to tell all the stories that I would like to tell. So I'm encouraging other writers and editors and publishers to do a deep dive. I mean, at the top of my list is Ida B. Wells. I would love to see a graphic novel about the life and accomplishments of Ida B. Wells. In terms of fiction, I think part of it is that we're seeing like the response to, say, you know, the Black Panther movie, and to a lesser extent the comic, but it's definitely there. I think it's that we're seeing characters depicted in ways. When I was a kid growing up, I'll give you an example. I mean, I loved Luke Cage when I was a kid growing up, but every time I read an issue of Luke Cage, me and my cousins would read it and we'd go, oh, this is great. This was written by a white person. Like, you just knew that it was fun and it was entertaining, but it was lacking any sense of truth, as much truth as a fictional character can have. And a lot of times these things read like they're written by white people who, this is their idea of what Black folks sound like. And that, you know, again, it can be entertaining, but it can also be problematic. We need to find some semblance of truth and humanity within these characters and not have it be just sort of like a pale impersonation of what we think Black people sound like. And you know, to that end, I'm, you know, still writing fiction. I'm also doing some nonfiction stuff. Got a couple things in development. And really champion this medium as a whole. I teach. I'm trying to mentor young writers and get them to a place where they can pick up the baton, because, you know, there's only so many books I'm going to be able to write. You know, if Frederick Douglass took me close to a year, more than a year, when you throw in the research and the writing, and I don't have that many years left to do all the things I'd love to do.
So Ida B. Wells, that's one you want to pass the baton on? You want to see it happen, but it's not going to be you who makes it happen?
I would love to write Ida B. Wells. I don't think, knowing what my schedule realistically looks like, you know, there's projects I can't actually talk about yet because we haven't signed the deals yet. But in terms of nonfiction, I'm probably booked up till about 2021 or 2022 with projects. And then there's a couple other things going on, a couple other big fiction projects. But yeah, Ida B. Wells is at the top of my list. She's such an endlessly fascinating person. I'd love to. Harriet Tubman is like one of my personal heroes. And there was a point when I was doing research for Frederick Douglass where I went down what I call the Harriet Tubman path, you know, because their lives crossed. I kept doing this all the time, you know. I ended up with a bunch of books on John Brown, and I was doing this research because research is my favorite form of procrastination. And then I realized, okay, wait a minute, I'm not writing this graphic novel about the life of John Brown. I don't need these five books that I have. And then at one point I was like, well, after this, I want to do John Brown, you know? So there's so many people, so many things that I would love to write about, but more importantly, I'd also love to read about it. We're never going to get to write every book that we want to write or record every song that we want to record or watch every movie we want to watch. And that's what other artists are for. And I would love to see other people explore and do this. And I think that the time is right, especially for topics like not just Frederick Douglass or Ida B. Wells, for, you know, Susan B. Anthony and the suffrage movement. I mean, I think we as a country need to be better educated. We need to learn more. And sometimes we just need to find the right way to get those lessons across.
Wow. I am excited to see what comes next. David Walker, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us.
Thank you very much for having me.
David Walker is an award-winning comic writer. He has been in charge of some of the world's most famous characters, including Shaft and Luke Cage. His new book is nonfiction. It's The Life of Frederick Douglass, a nonfiction graphic narrative journey.